Welcome to the Capital News. I am your host, Alex Kuraitis. Today is February 10th, 2020. Thank you so much for joining me. The title of today's podcast is 2020 Battleground States. We are going to start our analysis with the Electoral College. I had informed this audience multiple times during last year that I was going to hold off the analysis on a lot of the Electoral College business because it was just too early. Now that we are starting to get in the midst of the 2020 presidential campaign, this is sort of going to be a little bit of a kickoff with some of the battleground states, at least how I see it. I think this is in agreement with a lot of the political pundits and what is being discussed on a lot of the mainstream media. My list may differ slightly. Maybe I added a couple states that they don't have or vice versa, but we're going to talk about that. That's going to be the crux of today's conversation. But there are some other things that I do want to discuss before we get into that, because there are a handful of things that are worthy of discussion. So we're going to talk about market performance, obviously, a little bit of the coronavirus once again. We have the New Hampshire primary taking place tomorrow, so a little bit of analysis on that separately. But to kickstart off our conversation here today, we have a budget coming out of the White House at $4.8 trillion. You know, part of my, it's somewhat of a daily routine, I guess you could say, is before I really get going, I read a few articles in the morning, various news outlets, whatever the case might be. And I saw this the other morning, and I didn't know whether to scream or to go back to sleep. $4.8 trillion. This isn't like this is over the course of a five-year period or a 10-year period. No, this is the budget for one single fiscal year. Now, you would say, well, $4.8 trillion, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is. It is a ton of money. But then you have to understand, and you have to ask yourself, well, how much is the federal government expected to bring in over the upcoming fiscal year for which this corresponds? Well, if all goes to plan, maybe about $3.6 trillion. You don't have to be a mathematician. This leaves you a huge deficit, a deficit of $1.2 trillion. That assumes everything goes to plan and the federal government brings in $3.6 trillion, which in and of itself is questionable. Now, of course, the president, the executive branch, is not in charge of the purse, but the president does put forward their budget. Well, this is it. Now, it's unlikely that this budget in its entirety, at a market cap, if you will, a 4.8 or a price tag at $4.8 trillion is not going to go through. But that doesn't mean once Congress gets its greasy little fingers on it, that it's going to be $4.8 trillion just with their slice of the pie mixed in it. Might even be more. I hope it's not. But to my conservative friends out there, particularly my fiscal conservative friends, I can hear the screaming if Barack Obama was the president. All I'm asking for is a little bit of consistency. You may not like some of my recent analysis on the president. I don't care. My job here is not to be anti-Trump or pro-Trump. My job here is to be pro-truth, to give you my honest analysis as I see it. Sometimes you're going to agree with me, sometimes you're not, and that's perfectly fine. That's what this show is about. It's about debate, it's about ideas, it's about sharing those ideas. But just because I voted for somebody doesn't mean I'm going to turn a blind eye. So I want to know from my fiscal conservative friends out there, would you be so tolerant of a $4.8 trillion budget coming out of Barack Obama's White House? I can hear you screaming at the top of your lungs, so don't lie to me. Especially if it was going to create a $1 trillion plus deficit, which this one will do, at least 1.2, and I can assure you, it'll be even more. It will be even more if this goes through. He had $500 billion budget deficits, and Mark Levin and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingrams of the world screaming at the top of their lungs, this is shenanigans, this is ridiculous. We told you he was a socialist. We told you he's out of control. All he wants to do is spend money that we don't have. And their analysis was spot on. It was spot on. But guess what Barack Hussein Obama walked into? He walked into the worst financial crisis maybe in American history. Most definitely in multiple generations. 80 years. Okay? since the Great Depression. He came in, he had a $1 trillion deficit, a little bit more than a $1 trillion deficit. In fact, 1.2 trillion. By the time he left, it was cut in half, slightly less than that. Now, in a few short years, we have the Republican as a president, and we have the Republicans who are in control of both the House and the Senate for the first 2 years of the Trump administration, his presidency. And we have basically had $1 trillion deficits every single year. Because you have to understand, folks, and we've been through this before, especially when we talk about the economics, there's funny accounting that goes on with the government. You cannot just look at the simple deficit itself. You have to look at the total amount of debt that gets added to the national debt. And that's typically a little bit higher than what the actual figure is that comes out of the federal government when it comes to the deficit. So if the federal government is going to quote-unquote officially release a deficit of about $1 trillion, you can rest assured that the national debt actually went up maybe by $1.1 trillion or $1.2 trillion. So that will be the case here as well. Now, the fiscal conservatives were 100% correct in pointing this flaw out, even when it was $800 billion, $600 billion, even $500 billion under the Obama administration. But at least it got cut in half. Now, under the first few years of a Republican administration and a Republican regime controlling the purse strings of Congress for those first 2 years, you've doubled it. You've doubled it. And I don't hear any of these people screaming at the top of their lungs. No Sean Hannity, no Mark Levin, no Rush Limbaugh, no Laura Ingraham, no Lou Dobbs. In fact, all of these individuals claim that this is the greatest economy ever. And I have told this audience on a number of occasions, do not believe me. Do not believe me. Take your time, go on to Google, type in Federal Reserve Economic Data. The acronym is FRED. Those of you who also have checked out my capital economics presentations know that I use this source all the time for data because it's an aggregate of private data and government data. It's a great one-stop shop, okay? Go on that site. In the search bar, type in the following words, one by one. Construction. Retail, manufacturing, industrial production, transports, federal, state, and local tax receipts, corporate profits, jobless claims. Look them up. When you look them up and you click on that data, you're going to first come across what is considered the levels of the data, just the simple number, 10 billion, 20 billion, 100,000, whatever the number is. That's just simply called the levels. You have to go in and you have to do a slight manipulation of the data. Click Edit Graph, and there's going to be a drop-down. Scroll down, year-over-year percentage change. Click on it. Then you look at the data under a new light. Federal Reserve already posts the recessions, their grayed-out areas. Look at how the data's trending, and you tell me that this is the greatest economy ever. Do it. You're not going to be able to because it isn't, folks. I'm not here to lie to you. I'm not here to be a front man for Donald Trump. I'm not here to be a front man for Thunder Thumbs in the Republican Party. I'm here to give you the facts. I'm here to give you the truth so you can prepare yourself. You are not going to be diversified. You're not going to be vigilant if you want to live in la-la land. The rug can get swept out from underneath you so quickly it's not even funny. History tells us this time and time again. Everybody thought the Roaring Twenties was never going to come to an end, and then it did. And then it did. Everybody thought, well, my goodness, tech, the internet, how can people lose money? This is the best thing ever. This is going to be the future for the next millennium. All you got to do is buy something. Until everybody went broke and they lost 80% if they held it the entire way down. 80%. Reminiscent of what took place in the Great Depression and the stock market crash of 29. Fast forward only a few years ahead from that dot-com bubble in 2000 popping. Not even an entire decade. Then you run into one of the biggest debt crises, credit bubbles ever, with the subprime crisis. Global catastrophe. Global catastrophe. Everybody thought everything was going up. Housing prices can never come down, etc., 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 until it did. And were you ready for it? Were you prepared for it? I know the answer for most Americans, no, you weren't prepared for it. You weren't. Even people who trade this stuff and invest in these markets every day for a living, didn't see it coming. Do you think all of those bankers at Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and a countless other banks that went out of business, you think they, I mean, this is what these people do for a living. They were in the eye of the storm. They lost their jobs. They themselves lost their homes, their cars, maybe their families in the midst of it because of the financial stress. Some of them we know committed suicide because of the financial stress. This is serious. This is not a joke. This is not a game, which is one of the reasons I do not like the fact that the president, or any politician for that matter, talks up the stock market. It is not their business. It is not their business because it gives false hope to people. False hope. Most Americans in this country do not own financial assets. They don't. The ones that do, if they have them, on the average Joe, is probably in a 401k through their employer. Probably don't have that much money in it. I know they don't have that much money in it because I know the data. Most of these people are not in retirement, which means they cannot touch this money. Can they put it into cash? Sure they can. But are they savvy enough to do it? Do they know how to time it? Nobody knows how to time it. So it's just a paper gain. It's just a con job. It's just a confidence man continuing to push the narrative. Do not talk about the stock market. It is not the job of politicians to do it. It is not the job of the president to do it. Especially the president. He wields too much power. His words carry so much weight, it's not even funny. You have to judge a person with power not by how much they use, but by how little of it they use. That's how you judge them. And it's headline after headline, it's tweet after tweet. And it's not because there's organic growth. I just told you to go look at the list of things that make up an economy. Okay? Go look them up. That's your fundamental structural economy. You want to understand why the stock market continues to go up? It's not because of organic growth. It's in spite of it. It's because we have a Federal Reserve that is out of control. And a White House who continues to push for lower interest rates, quantitative easing, and even negative interest rates. And I don't know how many times I have to say it to this audience, but I'm glad to continue doing it because that's the purpose of this podcast. If you think that negative interest rates is a good thing, just wait till you get them. Just wait till you get them. Go ask the people of Japan how they're working for them. Go ask the people in Europe how it's working for them as well. Because we got some other news, some other hard data coming out of Europe that says, oh, there isn't a reflation trade going on. There is not an economic rebound taking place, despite their stock markets going up. No, no. Italy continues to go down. Germany continues to trend lower. France continues to trend lower, and others as well. And this, folks, is data that is coming out before the coronavirus episode, which we are still in the midst of. So we have had the second largest economy in the world, China, shut down for the past, well, going on, I think, probably about 3 weeks now because the Chinese New Year, they shut down basically for that. That's when this whole thing really got revved up because, well, I mean, it was taking place before this. We talked about this. They knew about it in December, but you got the phase one trade deal. Can we release it? What do they know? What do we know? We got the New Year coming up. There's supposed to be a lot of traveling. What type of panic are we going to cause here? Until it got to the point, horses out of the barn, cats out of the bag. People got to find out about it, but they're still suppressing the information. The Chinese Communist Party is suppressing information. The World Health Organization, I don't trust. But this is worse than the flu, ladies and gentlemen, because you do not have a country of 1.4 billion people on lockdown for the flu, for a typical flu. You do not have other countries of the world not flying into China or allowing flights out of China into their countries if this is just your run-of-the-mill flu. This is something big, or this is the grand conspiracy we're in the midst of. It's one or the other. I tend to think that this is something serious. Time will tell, but the second largest economy in the world has been shut down for almost a month, and there's a continuation that it will continue to be shut down going forward, at least to some degree. We know Hong Kong is not going to be opening their schools for another month. There are some countries that are not going to allow flights from China into theirs, at least until April. So you're basically talking the first quarter of 2020, the world's second largest economy, on lockdown. Those tourist dollars, everything coming to a pause. The supply chains coming to a halt. car companies in South Korea coming to a halt because they cannot get their car parts, their supplies, out of China. You continue to have the cruise liners suffering big time. That number on one of those cruise liners has doubled from 30 to some 60-odd individuals, and I believe some of them were Americans, who have contracted the coronavirus. Now, some people argue that, you know, because we still don't know how this virus is really transmitted, that you're just asking for trouble because you have all of these people on a cruise ship with nowhere to go. So it's just a cesspool. It's just a disaster waiting to happen. Maybe that's true. Maybe it isn't. We don't know. But there are more cases coming to the fore. So I don't think we've reached the peak yet. I hope we have, but I don't think that we have. And time will tell. But this thing is far from over. Yet, the stock markets, Europe, United States, especially here in the United States, continue to go up despite all of this bad news. Because what are they expecting? Well, bad news is good news, right? If things continue to deteriorate, well, Jay Powell and Daddy central government, their central bank, are going to come to the rescue. It's actually a combination of both. It is. It's mummy government and daddy central bank, because we got a $1 trillion deficit that's going to continue to fund this thing, and tens of billions of dollars on an overnight basis in liquidity injections. This is fake. It's propped up. I don't know how easier it is to explain it to you. Dow Jones gained 174 points for the day, up 0.6%. The S&P 500 gained 24 points, up 0.75%. The NASDAQ 100 gained 116 points for the day, up 1.25%. European markets were relatively down and flat based off of that economic news. So maybe there's not an entire disconnect over in Europe as there is here in the United States. Commodities, we continue to see oil getting pummeled. It was below $50 for quite a bit, but now WTI is trading at $50.31 a barrel. Brent, the international metric, is at $54 a barrel. Meanwhile, natural gas continues its downward descent, $1.78 per million BTUs. We have not seen prices this low. We're getting close, folks, to the Shell energy crisis back in 2015, 2016. That was the mini recession. So we're getting back to that point. We have gold trading at $1,569 an ounce, and silver at $17.76 an ounce. And again, I still strongly believe that we are in the midst of a long-term bull market in the precious metals space. Money printing, real negative interest rates is the juice for precious metals. Can they be manipulated? They are being manipulated. Look it up. J.P. Morgan continues to come out with these headlines that they are in some trouble. Now, how much trouble remains to be seen, but more headlines are starting to drip out about the precious metals markets being manipulated, because they are. But you want solid assets in your portfolio one way or another. I'm not saying, I don't give investment advice here. You know this. I give information. I give my opinion, what I might do or what I would do. You got to make your own decision, but be diversified. And when central banks around the world are printing money like it's going out of style, because it is, you have to have some sort of alternative. You just have to some degree. So that's basically some of the market noise that's taking place. Stocks in the United States are not allowed to go down until they do. And again, that could happen very, very quickly. Pay attention. Stay diversified, because you have basically two stocks, a couple of stocks, Apple and Microsoft. Their stock caps, their market caps combined, two stocks, Apple and Microsoft, their market caps combined are larger than the entire market cap of the German stock exchange. How long do you think that can be sustained? I mean, these valuations are through the roof. We have not seen stock valuations at these highs ever, some of them. Some you got to go back to the Great Depression. Some you got to go to the dot-com bust. Some you got to go to the housing crisis. We have not seen these types of valuations at these extreme levels in a lot of instances ever. That's why you got to be careful on this. $4.8 trillion budget. Where are the fiscal conservatives? I don't hear them, and it's a true shame. We have the New Hampshire primary taking place tomorrow. Hopefully this is not a debacle like it was in Iowa only last week, but time will tell. Of course, the Iowa is a caucus system. Here in New Hampshire, it will be a primary system, so it's one vote, secret ballot, Hopefully they have the count by the end of the night. There are some people calling for the DNC chairman, Tom Perez, to resign or for somebody to fire him and get him removed, because how can you mess up Iowa? Which is, to me, a legitimate question. I mean, you've had 4 years for this. You have an app that malfunctions, and presumably nobody ever tested it. I mean, is this amateur hour or what? Or is there another quote-unquote fix-in against Bernie Sanders? Because the Democratic Party doesn't really want to look good associating themselves with Bernie Sanders. Because Bernie Sanders, after all, folks, is an independent. He just caucuses with the Democrats. He's an independent. So are they trying to do the runaround on him again like they did in 2016 when he was running against Hillary Clinton? It appears like that might be the case. Now, are they going to be able to do such a thing in New Hampshire? Less likely. Less likely because it's a primary. New Hampshire obviously borders and is the neighbor to Vermont, which is Bernie Sanders' home state, so he's likely to do well. The real question is what happens afterwards. Will Joe Biden catch a little bit of a bid in South Carolina and Nevada? If he does not, if Joe Biden does not do well, and I mean really well, in South Carolina and or Nevada, he is going to be in a lot of trouble. Time will tell as to who will replace him, whether Amy Klobuchar might get a second hard look because she's somewhat a little bit more middle of the road, blue collar-esque, fits the female, obviously checkbox, that type of thing, Midwest candidate, those types of Midwest values that she likes to harp on. Will people go to Amy Klobuchar, or will she also suffer too big of a defeat in the upcoming primaries and caucuses to sustain herself? And will that lead to maybe what could turn out to be the genius move of mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg? Because he skipped Iowa, he's skipping New Hampshire, he'll be skipping South Carolina, and he'll be skipping Nevada, placing most of his emphasis on Super Tuesday and getting as many delegates as he possibly can, spending already about $300 and some odd million on television ads, and it appears to be working. Now, he's not just on TV. He is on a bus tour. Again, he is sitting down in diners. He is meeting with people, shaking hands, kissing babies, all that stuff. Again, I think Michael Bloomberg is likely going to get it. He was a Republican, an independent, now a Democrat. Remember, folks, Donald Trump was a Democrat, and now he's a Republican. So, you know, it goes both ways on this type of stuff. So we'll see what he can do. I think he's going to do, look, of all of the candidates that I have seen, if I was to be running a presidential campaign, it would be mimicking very closely that of the Michael Bloomberg campaign, because he is focusing in on the states that are really going to decide this thing, and we're going to talk about that here shortly. He is focusing on the real legitimate economic data, which we talk about here all the time, that this is not the greatest economy ever, that you have to dig deeper beneath the surface, beneath the basic headlines. And that's just the focus that he has, calling out the president on his lies, on his exaggerations. That's what you have to do. You have to show that you're the stable hand, that you're the person who is going to be a uniter, not a divider. And there's a lot of people in this country, I think there's a lot of Republicans, and most definitely independents, who do not like the divisiveness that comes out of this White House, that doesn't like the language that the president uses, that the tone that he uses. And people are, you know, I think they are growing sick and tired of it. I think people made a bet that Donald Trump was going to really try to deliver. Okay, drain the swamp resonated with a lot of people. Hillary Clinton was the quintessential poster child for the status quo. And the country, both left and right, are and were sick and tired of the status quo. That's why you have a grassroots movement for Bernie Sanders. That's why you have the followers of Donald Trump, because people are sick and tired and remain sick and tired of the status quo. Drain the swamp, $4.8 trillion, not even close. This is by definition not draining the swamp. By definition. The military-industrial complex is making more money than they've ever made before. And there's no end in sight. Major Wall Street banks are making more profits than they've ever made. The national security-industrial complex. Remember Edward Snowden, the whistleblower? The leaks with those major tech companies with giving the government a back door into their data. Facebook, Amazon, Google, or their parent company Alphabet now. Microsoft, Apple, you know the names. Coincidentally, not coincidentally, those are the same five companies that comprise about 20% of the stock market. Wow, what a surprise. These guys are doing better than they've ever done before. Drain the swamp? The kiddie pool hasn't even been drained. Give me a break. $1 trillion deficits, trade wars, farm bailouts. Does the list have to continue? Where are the fiscal conservatives? Nowhere to be seen whatsoever. Just continue to pump and dump. That's all this scheme is. Believe me when I tell you. History will prove us right. Because that's all we're doing here. You want to understand what's going to take place? You have to understand history. Now, I wish we had learned from the mistakes of the past, but we haven't. We are on hyperdrive right now. Creating and committing the same mistakes of the past. What do you think is going to be the outcome? I mean, this is not a difficult equation to solve. It's not. Have we kicked the can further down the road? Yep, but what do I say? The further we kick this can down the road, the bigger the problem is going to be. Not good. And most people are not going to be ready for it. Even people who do this stuff and study and follow these financial markets on a day-to-day basis are not going to be prepared. Because these drops, they come like that. It might take several months. It might take a whole year to go up 30%. It could take a month, month and a half to drop 20%. We witnessed that at the tail end of 2018. You ready for that? You're going to hold on? You're going to think, oh, well, it's just a great buying opportunity. We're going to buy the dip. It's going to go back up another 30%. You're so certain. What if it goes down another 5, 10%? Now you're wiped out. Now you're completely in the red. You're going to hang on? You're going to get out. These are serious questions that you have to ask yourself to be prepared, because these are the type of situations that can happen and they can unfold quickly. An entire year or a significant portion of a year's gains can be wiped out in weeks, months. Pay attention. Electoral college business in the battleground states for 2020, at least in my opinion. We have Arizona with 11 electoral college votes. We have Nevada with 6, Iowa with 6, Wisconsin with 10, Pennsylvania with 20, Ohio with 18, Michigan with 16, Virginia with 13, North Carolina with 15, Georgia with 16, and Florida with 29. This gives us a total of 160 electoral votes. Now, some of these states, you know, most of the states on this list were won by Donald Trump in 2016. Will he be able to maintain his, basically, let's just call it control, if you will, over these states in the 2020 presidential election? Well, we're going to find out. But what the Democrats have to understand is what Donald Trump and his team, his campaign team, understood very, very well in 2016, that this is not a national election. This is not a popular vote contest. This is a state-by-state electoral college contest, and it is the first to 270. And Donald Trump and his team understood this extremely, extremely well. Because you have to remember, folks, Donald Trump did not win the popular vote. And as far as the Electoral College is concerned, he barely won that. Now, his margin, of course, at the end of the day was large, because it's basically winner take all in most of these states. But he only won by about 70,000 to 80,000 votes. 70,000 to 80,000 votes. That's a small city in this country. It's a couple counties. You know, the arrogance of Hillary Clinton, who I, of course, did not want to win. I mean, her arrogance and that of her team basically said, well, we got all these national polls showing everything's fine. We don't have to go to this state or that one. Or at least that was the decision they ultimately made. They didn't go. And they lost. Maybe that little extra effort and we'd be singing a different tune. Now, again, I did not vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't like Hillary Clinton. I gave Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt. A little bit of a learning curve. When I started this podcast last year, I was defending this president left and right on the Russia collusion story because we were reading the documents, we were looking at the facts of the case, didn't add up. Now you continue through. I continue to be told about trade wars coming to an end, and it took a year and a half for it too, only to go back to where we were before the whole thing started. And that's not looking likely, especially with the coronavirus. I don't like being jerked around. I don't like being lied to. $1 trillion deficits. Nope, not standing for that. Negative interest rates, quantitative easing. No, hell no. Hell no, not here. Not going to tolerate that for a second. Then you look at the case of the impeachment. Facts of the case were not good for him. I am here about the truth. It's not about anti-Trump. These are his decisions. These are his actions. It's not MSNBC. It's not CNN. It's not Nancy Pelosi. It's not Chuck Schumer. And I don't like those people either. You know this. But those actions, those words, those are Donald Trump's. Understand that. Now, back to the Electoral College. There's no question that the Democrats, if they are going to beat him, have to focus on getting back that blue wall that Donald Trump destroyed. Pennsylvania, Ohio, some extent Ohio. Ohio goes back and forth, but Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. All right? Now, you have to understand something, folks. Even if Donald Trump should lose those states, and if he can flip Virginia, he can still pull this thing off. He can still pull this thing off. He loses, I believe it's Pennsylvania and Michigan, but flips Virginia for their 13 electoral college votes because Hillary Clinton won Virginia. If Donald Trump can flip it, he'll still get, about 273 electoral votes, and that's all he needs. He needs 270 to get it. So those are going to be the battleground states. Arizona, Nevada, there's 17 electoral votes amongst them. Trump picked up Arizona last time. Hillary Clinton got Nevada. What'll happen this time? Anybody's guess. It's probably going to remain the same. The Democrats have to get back that blue wall. Now, if Florida is in contention, which it usually is, and Trump should lose Florida and Pennsylvania, he's going to be in a lot of trouble. He will be in a lot of trouble. So, what might be a savvy play for the likes of a Michael Bloomberg, so to speak, if he gets the nomination? I think it might behoove him to pick somebody like a Governor John Kasich of Ohio. He can say that this is all about unity. This is about bringing the country together. I think you're going to have to, now this might not be that smart from the standpoint of the Democrat side. You know, the lefty loonies might say, oh, this is ridiculous. We're not going to put a Republican, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's not Trump. It's not Trump. If you want somebody that's going to be more calm, even-handed, less chaotic, then those are the type of demeanors that you're going to want in the White House. Now, sure, John Kasich is a Republican, and of course the Democrats might not like that. Well, guess what? Tough cookies. Too bad. Because what you're going to get, I think if you get a Michael Bloomberg as on the top of the ticket and a John Kasich as a VP, what you get is that call for unity. What you can get is that Midwestern value vote, if you want to go down that road, because Ohio is, you know, sort of right there on the gateway of the Midwest. Now, he may or may not pull Ohio over to the Democrat side with Kasich on the ticket. Who knows? But it's not going to hurt. It's not going to hurt. Now, what John Kasich might have to do, he might have to have some type of pledge, God forbid, if Bloomberg becomes president or whatever, and something happens to him, God forbid, then you have, Kasich is going to make a pledge, well, you're a Republican, who you're going to have as your VP, who you're going to appoint there, you're going to bring in a Democrat, you know, we'll get to that, we'll see what happens. But I think it's going to behoove them to have some sort of a unity ticket, because there's no way, assuming, again, that it's Bloomberg, a little bit more middle-of-the-road type of candidate, he can't put Bernie Sanders as a VP. He's not going to put Elizabeth Warren as a VP. You can't put that type of person on the ticket. You just can't, because middle America does not want a socialist. And I hope that this country never votes in a socialist to this White House. I don't like the fact that they're running around Congress. But I just don't think that the people in Pennsylvania and in Michigan and in Wisconsin, if you have one of these liberal lunatics up there who want to give everything away for free, that they are not going to, quote-unquote, come home to the Democratic Party. They're going to give Trump either another 4 years by either voting for him or by not coming out and voting for the Democrat. That's what I see. If they continue, the Democrats continue to go down this path. And you have James Carville, the Raging Cajun from Louisiana, former Democratic strategist and advisor to President Bill Clinton, coming out over the past day, couple days, making news, basically saying what we've been saying here for quite a while, that the lunatics who are gaining control of the Democratic Party are going to destroy that party and this country with it. Just like the far right will do the same thing. Both silos on the extremes are harmful to the country because everybody keeps getting further and further, deeper into their silos. But him coming out, James Carville coming out saying, look, we cannot be focusing on how many bathrooms there are. We cannot be giving free stuff away to everybody, health care, education, daycare, family leave. We can't be doing it. You have to focus on the issues that won. Because the Democrats, at least in the House, had a huge victory in the midterm elections in 2018. And that's why we got Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House once again. Okay? So understand this. There is an opportunity to bring this country together. And remember, folks, the divisiveness in this country is not Donald Trump's fault. It's not. But he sure as hell isn't making it any better. He is a symptom. He is not the cause. All right, a lot of the cause is we've had these people in Congress and in government for far too long. The problem is Donald Trump just continues to poke the bear, continues to name call, continues to have thin skin. I mean, that's just who he is. He's 70-something years old. He is not going to change his stripes. It's just not going to happen. So the country is going to have to do its duty, I think, and find somebody who is going to be the uniter-in-chief, not the divider-in-chief, because that's what he, unfortunately, has turned out to be. He has the capability to unite, and he's not doing it. He's given great speeches. I have stated this here many times on this podcast. I do my best to give credit where credit is due. Some great speeches where I thought he was going to rise to the occasion. But when you give me a $4.8 trillion budget, which guarantees me a $1 trillion deficit, when you flip the switch and call out when you're a candidate of the bubbles and the problems that exist because of the Federal Reserve and an out-of-control government, and then you come in and you call for more of the same, you've lost it. You've lost it. You've lost my respect. You're going to lose my vote. It's that simple. Though that's the crux of the matter. Otherwise, we're just going to be back here in another 4 years, another 2 years, whatever the election cycle is, arguing about the same problems. You want to solve them? You abolish the Federal Reserve and you abolish the federal income tax. But when you give more power to the Federal Reserve by allowing them to print more money, by allowing them to go into lower interest rates and calling for it, I can't stand for that. I cannot defend that because that causes so many of the problems that we have in this country that have led to the divisiveness in this country. I can't tolerate it. So if you're going to put more fuel on that fire, you've lost my respect and you've lost my vote. So those are the battleground states. We're going to do a lot more analysis on that. We'll get into the nitty-gritty, but I just wanted to sort of throw that out there because we are really starting to ramp up into the 2020 presidential campaign. There's probably about, at least seven or eight mainstream Democratic candidates still in the mix. Over the next couple of weeks, it's probably going to get cut in half, which is, you know, it's a good thing. Got to get down to the core four or five there. And then we'll see, we'll see the men from the boys type of situation and we'll go from there. Also, I'll probably talk about this some point this week. I received a response from my senator, the email that I sent in regards to the impeachment, just simply asking for the whole truth. It was a well-written response, articulate. I don't know if it was specific to me or something general that he is putting out for the type of response that I gave him, the type of email that I sent him. But nevertheless, I'll try to read that to you guys here. Again, well-written, articulate, but I don't like the argument at all. But we're going to go through that hopefully some point this week. So stay tuned tomorrow with the Democratic primary in New Hampshire. And on south we go from there. Thank you so much for joining me today, ladies and gentlemen. Please like, share, subscribe, get the word out, leave your comments. We do love hearing from you. Stay diversified, stay vigilant, and stay with the Capital News. I am Alex Caritas. Godspeed.